This is Kate Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This is being recorded on May 19th. Today we are talking to Corey Foy and Will Green, and we're going to talk a little bit about differences in design patterns, best practices, what you see sort of in the .NET world versus what you see in the Ruby world and why they're different. Why don't I let you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves and just tell people a little bit about your background.
All right. My name is Will Green. I've been a software developer for about 8 years now, been in enterprise software development for about 5 or 6 years, on .NET for about 4, and doing Ruby for actually about 5. Right now, I've been involved with the Iron Ruby project, trying to get some of the third-party libraries that make Ruby so awesome run on Iron Ruby.
Okay, and this is Corey Foy. I am a .NET guy, Ruby guy, former Microsoft engineer, having a lot of fun being independent now. I went independent in November, so primarily I stir up a lot of trouble in a lot of different communities and have fun hacking on both C# and Ruby code when I'm not deep in the bowels of .NET code with WinDBG.
Corey, were you with MCS or were you an actual SDE up here?
I was a PFE, so we fixed all of MCS mistakes.
I see, yes.
We were the SWAT team that basically was like flown in whenever everything was going horribly wrong so that the customers could yell at us while we figured out what it was. And I supported SharePoint.
Oh, you poor bastard.
Not only supported it, but lived to tell about it.
Yes.
So what got me interested in this topic is, if people have listened to the show before, I've been kind of dipping my toes in the Ruby and Rails waters. And I just noticed some differences in way the two platforms put things together, or what are sort of common platform, common patterns. And there are things that on the .NET side that people sort of obsess about, and they just don't seem to be talked about on the Ruby side at all. And I'm not really sure why. I'm interested in getting people's perspective on why is that. Is it something about the language? Is it something about the framework? Is it just they don't care about that?
But Kevin, you had some specific examples that you kind of wanted to tackle.
Yeah, I had a few. I mean, just as a starting point for the conversation. One obvious one is the whole persistence ignorance thing in the .NET world, where people like their ORMs, their object relational mappers, to be separate from their domain models, and they don't want to have a lot of persistence related stuff bleed into their domain models. Whereas in the Ruby, on the Rails world, it's all active record. Everything knows how to persist itself, and they don't seem to obsess about the persistence ignorance thing. So why don't we start with there? Do you guys have a perspective on that?
So this is Corey. So what I'll say is, it's like anything else. So if you build up an MVC, ASP.NET MVC app, and you are doing kind of basic CRUD stuff, it doesn't really matter what your persistence model is or how separated it is. And for a lot of a lot of kind of basic sites being written in Ruby and Rails, and that kind of sweet spot around the CRUD operations, it's kind of the same thing. But whenever you get into more in-depth, complex domains, you have to, it's about software craftsmanship, not about specific technologies and how you separate that out. So if you have complex domain logic, hopefully you're not mirroring that directly in your database, no matter how easy Active Record makes it for you. I mean, because Active Record is just, a Martin Fowler pattern, basically, and that is implemented by Rails and is implemented in lots of other languages. So you could easily do some of that stuff, right in .NET, and indeed we've seen some frameworks to do that. It just comes to the point of how complex is your domain model, how complex is your application that you're really writing.
And this is Will. I think the language also has quite a bit to do with it. With Ruby, you have this idea of mixins, where you can, pull functionality directly into your class. You're composing objects rather than, creating this big inheritance hierarchy. So it becomes very easy, very trivial to create to create your domain model and get persistence at the same time.
So when I look at a lot of code, sample code or what have you out on the net, and I don't see a lot of domain-driven design style applications, really complex domain models. Is that because I'm just not looking in the right place? Is that because people don't generally solve those kinds of problems using Ruby and Rails? Or is it something else that I'm missing?
No, so it's like anything else. Your first mistake is that you're looking at code on the web, and that can be a dangerous thing to do. But GitHub does have some good examples of some large-scale Ruby projects. And I think Will is right. It's a different approach. Like, so to me, so what drew me into Ruby way back in the day when I first saw it was that I was able to be so expressive with my code. So I didn't feel this need to have, you know, all of these objects and things like that. I could just express what I wanted to do, how I wanted to do it. And we've seen a lot, you know, we've seen not a lot, but some of that moving with the .NET framework, the dynamic keyword, for example. When I spoke at Mix 10 on Iron Ruby about 2 months ago, and, you know, showing the progression of how you kind of did dynamic calls and built up certain things before, and how the dynamic keyword is making that much simpler, shows that expressiveness is really vital, and that what we need to be focusing on isn't the hurdles of the code and what it takes to get there, and more about expressing the ideas of the model itself and kind of the business logic that we want to do as well. So I would say that on the one hand, you're going to see, I forget what the law is, but there's a law which says that your application tends to model your organizational structure. So one would say that .NET applications, similar to Java applications, are going to be more complex because they're modeling complex organizations that they're part of. And in Rails, typically you're working Ruby and Rails and smaller shops, smaller organizations that are moving faster and don't have time for lots of layers and lots of complexities and SOA architects who are protective of their web services and everything has to go through them. And there's a time and a place for both of those, but I think that, you know, whenever you start getting into these really large complex domain models, it's not so much that one language does it over the other, it's that you're able to be expressive in Rails, but you're also typically doing that in a way that doesn't require all of these layers just to build and maintain, you know, different applications.
Going even more low level than, you know, the different layers, just the ceremony involved with creating a Ruby class or a Python class, for that matter. There's a lot less, you know, public static void, all that noise that, you know, in the end doesn't mean anything to business. The real business value is in a language like Ruby or Python, is you can very quickly, very easily express the intent of the business without having to jump through hoops to satisfy the compiler.
So I would kind of go back, Kevin, to the question of what do you see, like, why do you think that you're not seeing domain-driven design, and what would that kind of look like to you in the Rails world from what you've seen?
Well, and of course, let me preface this by saying, again, I'm a noob, so I haven't seen all that much, but I guess
before you jump into that, that's okay. I guess my question is this. You know, if we look at I come from an agile background, and so part of that is all about incremental design, incremental architecture. So building out a lot of these things, saying, okay, we're gonna do model-driven design, it's more about building what the user needs and what is expressive, and then building out the design from there. So is your question, do Rails models and Rails applications become complex in an iterative manner that drives out a domain-driven design kind of, you know, model separation? Or why do Ruby people seem to not start more with model-driven architecture?
I guess my question is more the latter.
I think I can speak to that a little bit. So most of where I've seen Rails used has been in design shops. The 37 Signals was originally a design shop. And so they kind of started with the user experience. They started at the UI and worked backwards. So when you look at a lot of Rails apps, that's kind of what you see. You see basically what we would call view models being used to persist the data using Active Record and whatnot. The models are usually very tightly coupled to the view, not from a code standpoint. So, you know, you're not newing each other up and whatnot, but from, you know, the one-to-one mapping of, you know, the view maps directly to these models. You don't usually have intermediary view models in use that often in Rails. And with traditional DDD or domain kind of driven stuff, you tend to model in the domain first. And so then, you know, you kind of work both ways backwards. So you model with the domain model, and then you create the repository and the database and kind of take care of that end. And then the front end gets done afterwards as well. And that's kind of my general impression of Rails, that it was designed to work very well in a graphic design oriented kind of environment. So everything is very fast. And that's one of the reasons for the unit testing and the agility, is designers are always changing things. And so, you know, they had to be able to react very quickly to change the designs, or to change the persistence and the models and the logic.
Okay, Scott?
Well, going to Scott Kay's point about view models and you don't see those, I think that in a way kind of ties in with what Will was saying about ceremony for the compiler. And it always felt to me like a lot of this boiled down to not really static typing versus dynamic typing, but what was called manifest typing, which is where you have to explicitly declare types for variables and parameters and return values. And the fact that when someone's looking at a service endpoint or an MVC controller, and there's certain .NET types that see that you're returning an entity directly from your controller to the view or from a service, and they say, oh my god, you can't do that, that's sacrilege. Because you see those types, you see the type of that object, and you know it's associated with something that comes out of your data access layer or repository or something like that. Whereas in a language like Ruby, you're not really concerned about that type. The type is there, but it's not in your face, and the objects are very malleable, and you can pass these things around, and you don't really care where they came from. You just care about what properties they hold and what behaviors they have. Does that play into it at all?
Yeah, I think a lot of the times, you know, with my work in the .NET stuff, is you care more about what an object is rather than what it can do. You know, that goes back right to the whole, you know, static typing versus duck typing.
And so not to skip over K. Scott's question here, but I wanted to go back to something Scott K. said, which is the concept of outside-in development and where kind of things start from. And it's really interesting. We did, it was probably about a year or two ago, I ran a couple of Day of Ruby sessions around, I live down here in Florida, and so we did them around the state. And what we started with people was, these people had no Ruby experience, no Rails experience, and we started with Cucumber from the very beginning. And everything we defined was outside in, was that focus on what is the interaction, what is the user story that we're striving for, and then building things from behind there. And it was really interesting watching how people responded to that, which in effect is a form of test-driven development. For people who had never been exposed to TDD and never been exposed to Rails, and just kind of picked up from that. And so it led to kind of a different thinking about, not about so much the model, but about what is the experiences and what are the interactions that we're building with the system. So part of that may be a debate between model-driven and behavior-driven, you know, and what your approaches are on that. I tend to come more from a behavior-driven, but a lot of it also depends on the size of your system. I have a client that we're about to start that is an extremely large system that we're going to be starting work on, and that's going to have a different approach than just saying, oh, well, what are all of the interactions? There's definitely going to be a different approach architecturally, and that doesn't even really matter what the implementation language is. It just matters that we have a complex enough domain and a complex enough model to pull from there.
So I'm curious how much of that, I mean, there are definitely some language differences and some architectural differences in the platforms, but I'm curious how much of that is driven by, you know, the types, the community or the history, the different people that are actually using them, because you definitely could create, you could go view model first, you know, build out a stub repository and build things out in MVC, you know, focusing on design and interaction first. And there are some decent behavior driven design frameworks and systems out there. So, I mean, it's something where you could do it. Is it more, do you think that it's more cultural, or that it just, because it seems like there are some roadblocks, but declaring a type or like creating a class in C Sharp is not that, you know, I mean, there's not a whole lot in there versus a Ruby type, right? I mean, a Ruby class.
Well, kind of. You spend a lot more time talking to the compiler in .NET and C Sharp, at least from C Sharp and VB.NET. You know, of course, IronRuby and whatnot, it's a different story, but you end up telling the compiler what's going on a lot, whereas Ruby, the interpreter is kind of, you know, guesses, takes its best guess and goes forward with it. And if its best guess is wrong, then you get an exception.
I guess if you've got complex types, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, a standard view model that's kind of unrolled and it's focused on what's going to be in the view. A lot of the time, those aren't very complex types, and there's not a whole lot of, you know, brackets, and it's, you know, declare a class and throw some properties in there.
Right. So if you look at like, and Jeremy Miller owes me a beer again, but if you look at FUBU MVC and the kinds of like sample apps that you'll see made out there, or they talk about it, that you'll see very, very simple, almost Rails like, you know, models, view models. The Silverlight ones tend to be a little bit more complex, simply because various people have taken the MVVM moniker and ran with it. And there's also lots of attributes that you have to decorate around. So they look a little more complex, I think. But I think in general, it's cultural that, you know, the Java and .NET devs have spent, you know, so much time leaning on the compiler to tell them, you know, how things are going. And to be honest, it's much easier to talk to the compiler than to talk to your users, right? Users are messy and have ideas of their own. The compiler tells you when you're right.
Well, there's definitely that, and the idea of like, hey, if I've designed a good system architecturally and got everything lined up, I've done my job, versus focusing on user experience and the users. I mean, the whole, how does the design of the application work? Like, I think a lot of the time in Microsoft Java world, where people would think like, oh yeah, we'll have the designers clean that up, as opposed to like really focusing on that as a core value in your application.
The view model one is an interesting example to me, because I feel like, you know, if you don't use a view model in .NET land, you know, people sort of gasp in horror that you're passing around persistent entities and you're directly to a view, and it's just assumed that that's a bad thing to do. And yet over on the Rails side, they do it all the time. They're basically persisting their view models from one perspective, or they're just rendering their models directly without this intermediate layer.
I think maybe because the models in Rails are, you know, more lightweight than the models you typically find in .NET software.
That's what I was going to say. The models, and you look at EF for link to SQL, or God help you, data sets. You look at how tightly coupled they are to the persistence mechanism. EF is getting better with POCO models, but there's still a lot of, you know, kind of ceremony that goes into persisting them, from what I can tell. Again, I'm no EF expert, so take that with a large salt lick.
Well, but, you know, I think the thing is, and this is something that I caution people whenever they're comparing .NET, you know, to C# to Ruby specifically, is that, yes, Ruby has classes like C# does, and yes, there are, you know, objects and things like that, but there's the way that you approach concepts and programming challenges in Ruby, because of metaprogramming, is I think what accounts for some of those fundamental shifts. You know, what you have, you know, so yes, we're getting some of that with dynamic in C#, but, you know, the power of metaprogramming in Ruby to build out things and to express things and know that it's going to work is an extremely powerful concept. And the way that you express that, I think, leads to a different approach to how kind of you build your applications, which may even be in some cases slightly more componentized. You know, Will already mentioned mix-ins, but you know, in typical, you know, in .NET, when we have a class, that class gets parsed and, you know, into expression trees. In Ruby, that class gets executed as it goes down. And that fundamental shift changes not just how you think about the problems, but sometimes how you even approach them. And so things like persistence and things like mapping and things like that become just different, because you have a lot more power under the scenes. Now, The flip side of that is that you can write messy code in any language, and Ruby certainly is no exception, just like .NET is no exception. And so there are extremes to both sides. But I would say that that's something that has to be considered, is that it's not just saying, oh, we're taking classes and mapping them to a database or a data store, but there's fundamental constructs of how Ruby functions and how you approach problems in Ruby that changes that model. And it's very similar, and I'll just keep blathering for a second. It's very similar to how the approaches that we're seeing with functional languages, where if we're assuming that everything is immutable from the get-go, it changes how we fundamentally construct the problem and how we go to solve the problem. And I think metaprogramming has some aspect of that as well.
So not to put you too much on the spot, but are there any concrete examples you can give to kind of illustrate that point? I feel like sometimes the response that I get to these kinds of inquiries is, well, the language is so expressive, or the framework is so powerful, but I don't have it very concrete in my head how exactly that translates into what you're talking about.
Yes. And so you make a good point there, which is that I am not stating that one is superpowers over the other. I find myself working better in Ruby than I do in C#. As others have said, we're fighting the compiler sometimes. For specific examples, I mean, if you just look at the impact that that Ruby and Python and other dynamic languages have had on the C# framework itself, things like the dynamic keyword, things like how we approach views. Just a couple of shows ago, you all were talking about always writing your views in dynamic code. That those kinds of constructs have altered how we approach the problem. So now we're saying, like for views, for example, if our views are dynamic and written in dynamic code, how does that change the approach that we come to the problem? As far as specific examples, I guess like if we look at to go back to kind of tying things to the database, if we can say search by post ID and we don't have to do anything, we kind of get that for free by using Active Record, it becomes more likely that we will use that and be able to go much further with that than if we would had to have write that ourselves. And that's good and bad, because a lot of times that metaprogramming, that magic, as somebody kind of said, like magic strings, magic things that happening can lead to bad things happening and poorly written and poor architecture. So I don't know if it's necessarily saying, oh, if you use Ruby and you use metaprogramming, you're going to be awesome, any more than saying if you use C# and you use, link to SQL and you use whatever, you're going to be awesome. Because it's not about, those are all tools that are in your belt, and how you're able to use those and approach problems with them is what really comes to play.
I want to be awesome.
So just throw out another example on this along this line is, something that the .NET world, some people in the .NET world obsess over is this no magic strings concept, this idea that everything should be, you should be able to use your refactoring tools and get static type checking. And in order to do that, you need to have everything be run through the compiler, essentially. And obviously, in dynamic languages, you don't have that. So are there ways that those environments, those dynamic languages, compensate for the lack of that of those checks? Some people refer to this as resharper-driven development, right? The fact that you can use these static analysis tools to make your code more malleable.
So, Will, would you like to answer this? Because I think we both have a one-word answer for that, but Will may not.
You don't really need some of the refactoring tools that, ReSharper or CodeRush gives you. I mean, just the whole, you don't even really use an IDE for dynamic languages. Your IDE is your text editor, and you use the powers of the text editor to do your refactorings there. But, I mean, I don't know. Corey, what did you have in mind?
Okay, sorry, Will. If we look at, let's just bring up an oldie but a goodie, Smalltalk. Smalltalk is a dynamic language, and it had the ability to have a very expressive IDE with autocomplete and some very, very powerful features that we see now in Visual Studio and with ReSharper and things like that. So very heavy refactoring support in a dynamic language. And we're seeing that. We're starting to see that in some of the Ruby IDEs. So, but I think that If there's one thing that I find strange in the whole debate is that if we look at the Ruby world, the focus in Ruby and in Rails and in other dynamic languages is on testing. So Smalltalk is about writing unit tests. And so there's testing versus checking. So I'll say automated checking of code and writing automated check tests. And that is a huge benefit because that's just a core way of working with things. So like I said, with the day of Rubies that we ran, we did cucumber first development. So we're doing test first, and we have these supporting tests that are telling us how things are going. And so effectively, the compiler, if we think about it in the term of we're you know making the compiler happy, our compiler is our test. Does our code compile? No. Okay. Well, let's figure out why. Okay. Does our code compile now? Yay! We're all happy. If we just change that workflow to say, is our test green? No. Okay. Let's change it. Yay! It's green. We're all happy. Except for now, that continues to help us later on. The fact that we made the compiler happy with this line of code, you know, 17,000 lines of code later, they're all, you know, when the compiler breaks again, we don't know that that's because of the same thing that we had 17,000 lines earlier with the compiler. So tests is, I would say, that the biggest thing that helps with that.
So one other thing that I've noticed when working with Python, Ruby, JavaScript and my small forays into Smalltalk. One of the reasons that you need refactoring tools in C# and Java is because you're writing so much more code that it's harder to find all the instances of variable X or class Y or method Z. When you start writing Ruby and Python code, you're writing a lot less code, and it's not that hard just to do a find and replace. If you want to rename something or if you want to extract a method, you just select it, copy, paste it, and you know put a def and endef around it. It's not that hard. Every text editor that I know of, from Emacs and Vim all the way up to IDEs like RubyMine and that one from Sun. Actually, I wonder if that one's still around. Anyway, NetBeans, yeah. Will support, you know, auto completion, auto kind of closing of those methods in Ruby. So it's just, yeah, it's not that big a deal because even if you don't have tests, you're just not dealing with that much code. And so it's not that hard to find it. And you don't have as much duplication of effort, I don't think, either in Python, Ruby, and more dynamic languages.
So just to make this much more, just really tick off your listeners, what I don't understand is why we still even talk about not having tests. Like I don't want to sound like some zealot here, but trust me, I did, you know, test driven development back in the 1.1 days with ASP.NET and in-unit ASP, and I know how insanely, you know, nasty that was, and how difficult it was, and I understand the shying away from that. But as we've moved to more, you know, more different things and more ways of bringing unit tests in, like Team City just brings it, you know, just runs the tests if you're using Team City, you know, why we haven't seen more of the similar things that we're seeing in Rails. So where are automated builds? You know, why isn't Rake all over the place? You know, like active record migrations, why aren't we seeing, you know, more moves towards that? Instead, what I think that we're still seeing is a reliance on whatever the IDE gives us. And I think that that's probably another, you know, thing. We're happy because Visual Studio in the .NET world is effectively all we have. And so whenever we have something that does pretty things and does pretty animations in Visual Studio, we're very happy with that, without saying, well, why aren't we doing some other things here? Why aren't we relying on our unit tests along with the refactoring support to do these things? Why are we calling it refactoring and we're changing 300 source files, or we're changing 700 lines of code? Those are the fundamental questions that I would like to see us asking, instead of some of the other ones that seem to come up and that we go around and around with.
Well, I think part of the reason why you're changing 300 lines of code kind of goes back to what Scott Kay was saying. There's just so much less code in, you know, when you're writing Ruby stuff. I mean, the last big Ruby Rails project that I did, my largest files were my cucumber feature files. You know, I could fit just about every single class in, you know, in one screenful in my IDE.
But Will, I'll take a devil's advocate to that, which is that the few codes that you wrote were because the Rails framework underneath does configuration over, whatever. It doesn't use XML. Thank you. Convention over configuration. And so there was a lot of things happening behind the scenes to make it that easy to use. And so, but when something goes wrong, you know, you can run the tests to see what's going on. You can crack open the code to see what's going on. And so there are things like that, but I wouldn't say, I want to caution us to compare this based on number of lines of code, because the things that are happening in the Ruby world can be just as complex as what's happening in the .NET world and not necessarily being as expressive. So this goes back to metaprogramming, which is that if I'm coming over and I type find by ID, I don't have a method anywhere to find by ID, and I don't understand where that's coming from. It's magic. And so expressing that magic is something that is a hurdle you have to overcome with Rails, whereas in the .NET world, you don't have that magic. You get to type that yourself and kind of see right where it's coming from. So I just want to caution us not to go down the, oh, well, Rails doesn't need refactoring because it has less lines of code.
Perhaps less lines of code was a poor phrasing on my part. It's more about it being more, to go back to the E word, expressive. I mean, it's very easy, very straightforward for me to express the intent of, you know, the objects that I'm writing versus .NET when C#. I'm writing a lot of you know, keywords, again, just to satisfy that compiler. And I think that having to write so much to satisfy the compiler is probably part of what turns people off from writing unit tests, much less, you know, after the fact. Forget about before the fact.
Well, so I'll throw in my two cents here for the number one thing that I think stops people from writing unit tests. Okay, I'm going to say two things, at least in the .NET world. One is that they're still confused about what they should test and how much they should test. I get this a lot from people who are scared or frightened of doing unit testing. They don't know how many turtles down they should test, and they're afraid they're going to be writing tests around the string class, you know, because you're supposed to have 100% coverage. You're supposed to, you know, test everything, have everything under a unit test. And so they just stop. And I try to convince them that, you know, just, you know, get as much under there as you can. You know, just test the stuff that you know is important, and then test the stuff that's supporting the stuff that's important. And don't worry, you know, just it's you just got to write them. And the second thing is that it's so damn hard to mock stuff in the .NET framework, because you do get to the point where, you know, you eventually run into a framework class that is final, sealed, internal, and whatever. And you know, there's just and they're just not used to doing decoupled code. So they're just not used to doing DI and injecting their dependencies, and so that they don't know how to test something when the first three lines of their class is var something equals new something, var two equals new something, var three equals new something. It just confuses them, and you know they don't know how to get around that. And so maybe after we dissect my horrendous claims there, we can go back and talk a little bit about why. You don't see very much DI, and you do see some IOC, but I think that's mainly because Ruby is more message-oriented, and people forget that IOC means inversion of control. They think it means container. So, yeah, if you guys want to talk about some of my outlandish claims there.
So to talk about the internal sealed and, you know, essentially reaching a brick wall with .NET, I run into that all the time. And you just don't hit that with Ruby, because all classes are open all the time. So you can just reopen it, add methods, change methods, bingo, you're done. In fact, that's what I did for this one library, iron term ANSI color. So the Windows terminal is very poor with colors, with providing colored output, which is really helpful for the TDD cycle. So I just reopened up reopened the console, the console out methods, and now it actually parses these ANSI strings and sets the colors properly. I couldn't do that in .NET. That's something I had to put, you know, drop down an iron Ruby to do. So being able to just reopen anything is an amazingly powerful feature. And because of that, you just don't need some of these techniques that you see a lot of energy focused on in .NET.
Going back to something Scott said earlier was I'm thinking about, you know, culturally or just kind of the flow of development, why people don't think about testing until it's too late and it's difficult. You know, maybe their application's difficult, or they've kind of just built up development practices that make it difficult. But like you're saying, it's easy enough to look at the compiler as the first test, and you get enough tests, or, you know, I mean, so your site compiles, you think it's good, you know, you click around on it, you manually test it, and then that's giving you some amount of test coverage. Now, probably very low, but it gives you some confidence. And, you know, like, again, just to be clear, it gives you some false confidence, but it gives you some confidence. Whereas if you're writing something in a purely dynamic language or a more freeform environment where you're expected to be writing tests to make sure that it works, you're going to start at the beginning and you're going to build your, you're going to architect your code in a way that it is testable because you have to. Does that sound right?
So the compiler becomes a crutch at that point.
Well, and not, so I think the compiler gives you two things. One, you know, it'll give you type checking. It'll tell you, you know, it'll do some basic kind of testing for you, right? But then it also gives you things like, okay, I know that this is a date time, so I've got IntelliSense, or I've got, you know, I can query over things and Link is going to, you know, I mean, it's easier to write that code because there's more of an understanding of what each object and type provides, whereas in a more dynamic language, there's you know, I mean, there's obviously quite a bit less of that, and you're expected, like, so you've taken over control in a good and a bad way. You've now, you lose some of those niceties during developing, but then you also, the compiler's out of your way, and you're free to do what you want to do. Does that sound correct? Crazy?
No, here's what I will say. The focus of most or a majority of the developers on .NET, and probably not necessarily the people listening to this podcast, but most people are, you know, developers in enterprise shops who don't care about craftsmanship, don't care about unit testing, don't care about, you know, good designs, you know, have never read Eric Evans' book, don't even know who that is, don't know who Uncle Bob is. These are the people that drive out most of the features. The one thing that struck me about at the Mix conference was that how much focus there was, and this goes back to the conversation we had about little, you know, little code, was that oh, look, we can drag and drop these features on here and just five lines of code hook this up to an enterprise data store and make everything magic. And that turns a lot of people on. That makes people wake up all giddy to be able to do that stuff. For a lot of us, it doesn't. Like, I can't imagine doing some of that stuff. Let's be clear that the target market for unit testing and unit testing tools is not the people who are doing refactoring, are not the people who are doing unit testing. It's the people who are really paying the bills, and that is, you know, the people who are building these enterprise applications by literally dragging and dropping components around and wiring them up with code. And it's kind of like you know, code and pray, or prayer driven development. You know, it compiles, ship it, and hope that the testers catch whatever's going on.
So Scott mentioned inversion of control or containers. And that was one that recently, like, I felt like a complete idiot, because I'm thinking, okay, so, you know, it's so ingrained in me now that this is what you do. You know, you invert your dependencies and you use a container to inject them, and you do that so you can mock your dependencies. And I was looking at some Ruby code thinking, well, how do you do that? Are there containers in Ruby land? And, hopped on a Skype call with, Rob Connery, and he just, like, you know, gave me the attitude adjustment. Like, you don't have to do that in order to mock something out. You can just replace whatever function on the object that you want to replace, and it you don't have to do, you know, inversion of control. So that kind of stuff has been a real, you know, mind shift for me. There are just things that you just don't have to worry about in Ruby land.
Well, and you know, I think one of the interesting things, Kevin, is that when you have inversion control in .NET, it's so challenging for, you know, for various things, as we've seen, you know, as Will kind of talked about with sealed classes and you know, all of these things, that trying to roll your own can be very challenging. And so you start looking at frameworks out there, and so then you bring this framework into your life, and you kind of marry it, and then so you start using all of these things that are there because, well, darn, they're there. And that and in Rails or in Ruby, in the Ruby language, because you don't have to have because it takes you so long to get to the point where you would need a mocking framework or something, you're less likely to fall into that trap of, well, I have the mocking interface here. I'll just jump in and mock everything. I mean, because if you know, there's four types of test doubles. If you think about it, like there's dummy objects, which we just literally don't care about. And we have like fake objects, which are in-memory databases. And then we have our mocks, which actually care about the expectations of what's going on. And then we have our stubs, which provide kind of canned answers. And what we end up with a mocking framework is using mocks for everything or using stubs for everything and not asking ourselves, are we adding a little too much complexity? Are there ways where instead of mocking this out, we should be refactoring it? Like in some ways, is the framework actually causing us to automate complexity or not feel the pain that we should be feeling by trying to mock out an object that takes 17 objects in the constructor? And I think that's an interesting challenge no matter what language you're in, is that when you start bringing in these frameworks, you kind of get married to them, you kind of start using more and more features just because it's there.
So just to bounce that back, though, if you are working in something like that example you gave where you've got 17, you know, objects in the constructor, I mean, that seems like that would get out of hand regardless of what you're doing. Like that could get difficult to manage obviously that's an anti-pattern and you're pointing it out, like you should refactor at that point. But I mean, when you do get into really complex object models or things like that, are there points where you hit limits and you do want, you know, like you do need more force structure in the language and, you know, where you do wish you had static checking, that sort of thing? Or is it, you know, does it scale, I guess is what I'm asking.
Can Rails scale? Is that what you're asking?
No, I'm not going down I'm saying, does the architecture scale? You know, like does your architecture, so it's easier to get started. It's easier to work at a thing and say, you know what, I don't need a compiler. I got it. I'm going to write my tests. And so I'm not talking about performance-wise scale. I'm talking about does the architecture continue to work and scale to the point where, say, you've got a huge, enormous application. Does it get unwieldy eventually?
It all comes down to discipline, you know, and I think that I think that you can get yourself in trouble in any language, as I said earlier. And I think that poor Ruby developers can really screw something up much better than poor .NET developers can. You know, with really bad .NET developers, if you really get in a jam, you can call Microsoft and they'll fly an engineer out to learn your application and unwind whatever is done. You pay dearly for that, but that's there. You know, with Ruby, if you get somebody who is just jumping in and saying, "Woo, metaprogramming, wee," and, you know, does all these things, you can really create some complex messes that are a nightmare to try to back out of. These architectural discussions are difficult to say whenever we're talking about language independence. Now, the interesting question is, would static typing help you from getting to the point where it's more complex as opposed to dynamic typing? That's, I would disagree with that, but I know that there are people who would take the other side as well.
But what about COM interrupt? No, I'm just joking.
That's where you get your 17 object constructor from.
Null, comma, null, comma, null.
So how do things like the introduction of lambdas, and let's not say the introduction, let's say the more widespread use and understanding of lambdas, and the introduction of the dynamics keyword and optional parameters, how does that affect kind of the complexity, do you guys think, surrounding .NET classes in general?
Well, certainly there's the opportunity to make it a little more complex. You know, your typical .NET developer just doesn't even understand the basic concept of a lambda. So you start throwing in lambdas for, you know, delegates. People scratch their head, go, huh? But so the opportunity to make the class more complex than it needs to be is certainly there. That said, the power you get from being able to do that is amazing.
Well, and so it goes back to what you all talked about a couple of shows ago with functional languages, and it's a different way of looking at things. Of, you know, what if the return result isn't a value? You know, what if we're truly using ask don't tell, and what we're getting in return is actually functions instead of values that we're doing something with or that we're modifying? You know, what happens if we think of things as immutable instead? If we have immutability and dynamicism, what happens then? How do we approach the problems then? The anonymous, whatever that, the anonymous functions, you know, that was an interesting way of approaching things, because now it's not this weird thing, but we're just saying here, you know, we're being more expressive in what it is we're doing, because before we're kind of building up a wrapper object and calling that. But, you know, with anonymous, okay, well, now we're just passing in a lambda of what we want it to do, and that becomes slightly more expressive. Now, of course, you can get complex with that. And so I think that what that does is not so much cause architectural concerns, but what it does cause is a way of expressing things in a different manner that allows us to think about the domain and the problem differently. And that's kind of a little different than thinking about the actual architecture of the application and the model that we're working with, or the domain that we're working with, but it allows us to approach the problem differently.
So one of the interesting things for me of watching, you know, .NET 3.5 and all the new C# features is they put all this stuff in there primarily for link, and then people went and took it to the next level and did really interesting things with, you know, expression trees and they sort of, the community had to go out and figure out these really interesting, powerful techniques. And I'm wondering whether dynamic is going to be the same kind of way. I mean, I feel like that they're kind of throwing dynamic out there in .NET 4.0 and not really telling people how to use it. And, you know, are we gonna now see that the community take it, kind of figure out what to do with it? And is that going to evolve, you know, C# into more Ruby-esque kinds of patterns, or will it be something that's uniquely C#? You guys have an opinion?
So I think the adoption of the dynamic keyword, I don't think there has been a lot of guidance from Microsoft on what that's for, other than, you know, com interop. That's the big story you hear around the dynamic keyword. But I think as Iron Ruby and Iron Python get more and more use and you start using them together, that's going to become more popular and people are going to start coming up with some very interesting ways of going about things.
Are you using interesting as a euphemism for completely screwed up?
Not necessarily, but there's certainly that potential.
So one of the things that scares the hell out of me is in C# 5 is getting the eval, or the compiler as a service, available in there. I'm scared to death that we're going to start seeing actual code stored in SQL databases pulled out and evaled, you know, with maybe some string replacements. It makes me pull out my Ruby and Python books every time I think about it, actually. Compiler is a disservice, exactly. It's coming. We're going to see, people aren't going to be using lambdas and expression trees anymore because that's going to be too complicated. It's much better just to store your program in a string and eval it.
Let me just say, I've seen some interesting abuses of reflection kind of along those lines, and I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and you know, I think the good and bad thing is that you're still running into the limitations of what it means to be a static language. So in Ruby, you know, an eval can modify the definition of a class and can do all kinds of very interesting things. So I mean, you can eval the reopen of a class using a metaprogramming technique and do all kinds of very interesting things. But then, you know, in .NET, you're still stuck with saying, well, I can't unload an app domain. I can't, you know, modify certain existing things. We still have, we've got with sealed classes. And so those are different things that you're still going to deal with because you're in a .NET framework. So no matter what we have with dynamic and no matter what we have with eval, there are still fundamental challenges you're going to run into because of the nature of the language itself. Yeah, and so yeah, another aspect of that is the template. So how many people are seeing the T4 templates and the template languages and what is that? We're auto generating code instead of being more expressive. So behind the scenes, instead of it being able to take advantage of language constructs, the option that we have is to generate, you know, thousands of lines of code. You know, I had one team that I coached where their entire definition of things were stored in Excel spreadsheets and their entire data access layer and everything. And they had a giant auto generation process that would run and convert that to their base data access libraries, Excel spreadsheets. And you know, that's an abuse of the language that we see with sort of like templates and code generation, where, you know, there are much better techniques for doing things like that out there. So, but maybe Scott, were you thinking of something different?
In terms of, no, I was thinking just the evil things that will happen. I was thinking, you know, that once we get eval, then, you know, we'll get macros, and then we'll eventually end up with templates and C++ style templates in C#, and the circle will be complete.
Indeed, all we need is malloc, and we'll be good.
We have it. You can do unsafe. You can do unsafe C#.
Oh,
people
yeah,
are
yeah,
just
yeah.
scared to, and with good reason. They're scared to. Let's see. So we've covered. We've talked. We haven't talked as much about DI. You know, I don't see. I guess I do see some dependency injection. When I've tried to unit test Python code, I found myself trying to inject things in there rather than you know, trying to do a kind of out of band mock, so to speak. But I never, since I'm such a Python noob, I don't know if I'm doing it right. And all the Python people that are really cool are in Europe, it seems. So I can't ever sync up with them and ask them questions. I guess there's a few here in the States, but they have jobs, so I don't ever get to talk to them. But I certainly don't see a lot of injection in Ruby, and I'm wondering if that's just because it just doesn't matter, because you can mock anything you need, so why do you need to inject? Similar to JavaScript, where you can just replace whatever you want on the prototype or the object.
Yeah, if you're playing along at home, now's the time when you drink.
Ta-da! I'm thinking about the folks at home. That's what I'm doing.
So to get them good and drunk, and the craftsmanship, no, I'm just kidding.
See, I was thinking if we ever had you and Corey Haynes on the show, we'd sound like some kind of kids craft show. Just craft this, although, craft that, craft, 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 craft.
Although if you play the craftsmanship drinking game there, that show would be about 15 minutes.
Because everybody would be passed out.
And then just, yeah, 30 minutes of vomiting later.
So, you know, to cover dependency injection, I mean, I think it comes down to it's much easier to be able to mock out those dependencies and to inject things in as part of just your normal way of working. You know, so in whenever you're dealing with C# and you're trying to like mock out a dependency, so like a common one is date time. So if we need to be consistent in our unit tests with date time and a function that calls date time now. And this is a common thing that trips people up. I need to write a unit test which tests something that it outputs the current time. But the only way that I can do that is to either know exactly what the current time is or to set the time to something and make sure that it actually outputs that. And so to inject those kinds of things in, now we're suddenly having to inject constructors and we're having to do, you know, all kinds of things. Whereas in Ruby, we can literally redefine the date time methods to say now returns this exact date string. And so we're not having to modify our code at all. It's calling now effectively on the date time object and getting back what it thinks is the current time. Whereas in the .NET framework, effectively the only way to do that, unless you're using Iron Ruby and testing at that level, is to inject in the object that you're going to get .NET, you know, .NET framework, or you're using some of the other frameworks that are out there to inject those kinds of things. But then that goes back to the framework discussion. In Ruby, I just say, you know, basically alias the now method to, you know, to something else and define the now method to say return, you know, some specific string, and my code doesn't know any the better and I don't have to change anything to inject that in as part of it. Whereas in .NET, you just don't have a choice but to put that in there.
So we've thrown out a few examples of platform differences. Anything you guys want to throw out there as ones I should be aware of that we haven't really mentioned?
Ruby is love. How about that?
We could just edit this whole part out.
Wait, yeah, I thought calm was love.
Calm was love. Well, there. What are the differences between calm and Ruby, you know?
That's an interesting question.
it all boils down to iDispatch.
Right? That's right.
Calm was the original dynamic platform.
Big iDispatch, yeah.
Yeah. All we need is, you know, that and variant, and we're good. And we have all the dynamicism we need right there. We're set.
Well, I am curious. You were talking earlier about I mean, through all this, we've been talking about differences in languages and differences. And are there things that you could see being added to .NET or MVC that would bring some of these benefits in? Or is it just kind of fundamentally different? Like, it's just the two will never meet and it's, you know, one or the other.
I certainly think there's room for the two languages to even, you know, play together in the same project. The move of C# to be more what I would consider more Ruby-like has been a welcome change. I find myself less often saying, "Oh, I could do this in two lines with Ruby," instead of the 15 here in C#. So I think the closer we get to that, to being able to have that terseness in C#, is the better off we'll be.
And the second thing that I've really been happy to see was, you know, with John Lamb coming onto Microsoft a couple years ago, you know, and the push from the ASP.NET MVC team, you know, I'm glad to see that moved away in a public way, kind of away from that, let's shove everything, all of our business logic into our views, and let's really seriously talk about separating out our concerns and kind of just building our code the right way and doing the right things, and even maybe sneaking in unit testing here or there, even though the support still isn't all that great. You know, it's there. And I'm glad to see that movement for some of the things. I am concerned with the dynamic keyword, with eval, what kind of interesting challenges that'll bring. But I'm well-versed in WinDBG, so I guess I'll still have a nice consulting career ahead of me.
Right. So there's language side, and there's also the, you know, the tool side or whatever. But I'm wondering, like, there are some code analysis tools in Visual Studio, and I'm wondering, like, if those, like, number one, automatically, like if that surfaced it more, where you got warnings when you built your you do file new project, you throw some crap together, and then you get a bunch of like warnings, or by default even flags them as errors, like you've got no coverage, you've got no, you know, like, and like I wonder if it could even push you. Now, I mean, that's kind of band-aids on it, but it could at least kind of, it could prompt people to by default do things the right way. I don't know. Just randomly thinking.
The only thing that's going to prompt people to do things the right way is when we start lifting up the right way. I mean, so we can have all of the code analysis that we want out there, and we can create custom rules and look at code coverage numbers and things like that. But as long as we still have thought leaders and organizations holding up and rewarding heroes and people who are willing to say, "Well, I didn't need no tests. I came in and saved this project." That's a huge thing to overcome. That is, you know, way fundamentally more important than trying to bring tooling to it. So in the Agile Manifesto, if we want to start a drinking game with that, it's individuals and interactions over processes and tools. And we tend, especially as engineers, to bring in process and tools to help us with that. When really it's a matter of what we lift up as values. You know, not to put you guys on the spot, but how many of you do test-driven development? And if not, why not? And it's a hypothetical question, because now if we start asking that, as somebody did, I think at the Austin Visual Studio launch, I think it was, or the Dallas Visual Studio launch, you know, three people in a giant auditorium raised their hand that they did TDD, and that's a huge thing that we have to overcome, that no tool is going to help us, because why would you run it to say that our code coverage is 10%? And then the worst part is, then we turn around and say, "Oh, our code coverage is 10%. Our goal should be 100%. Well, that's friggin' insane. Like, there's no reason for your code coverage to be 100%. But now people are being metriced and whipped for not having that. And I you know, that we have a whole fundamental disconnect that we have to overcome, and that's I think is what allows that kind of fast movement in other languages, as opposed to the more organizationally friendly languages, is that we have a feeling that we're rewarded for being heroes, and we're rewarded for just cranking out, and we're being measured on lines of code instead of the value that we're actually delivering and the quality and things like that. So a tool would be great. They're out there. You know, you can certainly measure cyclomatic complexity, and you can measure code coverage very easily. And, you know, you can measure number of unit tests, and you can do all these things. But I come across people time and time again who go, "My manager won't let me write tests." And it's like, your manager shouldn't be in charge of writing your tests. You know, your manager doesn't care if you use, you know, Link. And if they do, then you have more fundamental problems, you know, but that's a disconnect that we have to overcome, that processes and tools aren't necessarily going to solve.
Yeah, so kind of echoing that cultural thing, you know, what we hold up as values, what we say this is what we believe in. I think Microsoft's stance of, you know, in the past of not really taking a stance on any one thing, you know, data access, for example, how many different ways are there to you know, map your objects? I think the fact that Ruby on Rails has said, look, this is the way we do it. You can do it some other way. It's going to be painful and you're not going to get all the, you know, the nice nifty things that make development in Rails so quick, so easy, you know, that they've taken a stance and said, this is what we value. This is the way we do it. Do it your own way if you like, but you're going to pay for it. I think, you know, once Microsoft starts taking a stance like that and valuing some of the things that lead to better code quality, you know, and better maintainability, you know, I think we'd all be better off for it.
So the testing discussion reminded me of another area that I want to ask you guys about. It seems like in the .NET world, there's a lot of emphasis on fine-grained unit testing, you know, testing components, controllers, models. And I gather, again, noob here, but I gather in the Rails world, there's more movement toward what you might call integration testing, or with a sort of behavior-driven bent, where you're actually, you know, writing tests that are looking at the output of your view, and that might even include, you know, loading test data into a database and working with real models. And it seems, again, like a little bit of a different philosophy. Any comments on that? Am I reading that right?
So I certainly think you have a movement recently to do more outside-in testing, but that is not to say that we eschew any type of unit testing altogether. In fact, you know, Cucumber, you know, the favored BDD outside-in framework, Cucumber, and, you know, Cucumber works very well with RSpec. And a lot of the times you'll drop down to RSpec once you get this failing Cucumber scenario. So yes, I think there's a focus on the outside, because at the end of the day, that's what the user sees. But there's still a very strong focus on unit testing.
So do we want to talk anything about kind of Iron Ruby?
So what do you want to know about Iron Ruby?
I don't know. We've been kind of talking about, you know, how hard it is to do things in C sharp and how these things aren't necessary. But do these things go away necessarily just because you're using Iron Ruby? Because you still run into the same kinds of problems. You know, it's hard to mock things from the .NET framework, whether you're doing it in C sharp or you're doing it in Iron Ruby.
So those things kind of do go away to a certain extent. I mean, you know, you can pull any .NET object into Iron Ruby, into the DLR, and work with it there and alter it. But going back out to, you know, the CLR, you don't get those overrides that you define in the DLR. So you do have that kind of mutability, that, you know, the runtime mutability, which is great for testing. But, you know, at the end of the day, you still have those issues.
So anything you guys have interesting coming up? Anything you guys want to talk about? You know, presentations, seminars, anything you want to pimp?
Sure. I don't know how many people in Tampa listen to this podcast, but next Thursday, I'll be giving a presentation on Iron Ruby for Rubyists, why you'd want to look at it in the first place and what value it brings.
And this is Corey. I'll be at in Norway in 2 weeks speaking on a very cool topic called innovation games, which are a lot of fun. And then we'll have the Agile. If anyone follows the Agile 2010 conference, the whole Gaylord Hotel that we were going to have it at is underwater, so it got moved to Orlando, which is great for people like me who live in Tampa. And so we'll be speaking on a lot of fun stuff like distributed teams and innovation games, and there's a lot of very interesting things happening there. And of course, me being the independent, if you need anything, you can certainly reach me through my blog or through Twitter or through email or however, just call.
Yeah, I need some help with PSS Core 2. I'll talk to you after the show.
That would be, I just did a 5-day training class for a group up in New Jersey on WinDBG, and we covered PSS Core 2, and that was some interesting, fun, interesting stuff. That is a brutal topic, but a lot of fun.
Brutally fun.
Brutally fun, yes.
All right. Well, that should do it for another episode of Her and Goat. Thanks for listening, and see you next week. Thanks, guys.
Thank you all.
Thank you.